A text that has been helpful for me at any time of the year, but especially in times of evaluation and reminder as I think of the year ahead, is found in Hebrews chapter 12. So I'd ask that you turn your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 12, and we will look at the first two verses that we find in that chapter this morning. The paragraph actually goes to the end of verse 3, but in the time that we have, I want to focus our attention on these first two verses. And just by way of reminder, as you consider the letter to the Hebrews, the writer of this letter writes to a mixed audience. Now, most of those whom he addresses are those who have confessed that Jesus is the Christ. They were Jews who had come to recognize that Jesus of Nazareth was the one who fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies. He was indeed the Son of God, the Son of Man, the King of Kings. They had placed their faith in this Jesus as their Messiah, and certainly that faith was not something easy to live out. Expressing trust in Jesus as the Messiah immediately brought with it many hardships. And so there were those in this audience, those believers, who facing significant opposition and persecution were starting to have their doubts. And so the writer writes this letter to assure them of the superiority of Jesus Christ in all ways. There were also some within this crowd who made superficial professions or at least showed some kind of interest in the person of Jesus. And so the writer writes to those Jews as well to exhort them that today is the day of salvation and that those who heard this good message of glad tidings, to those who heard of the superiority of Jesus, that he was indeed the climax of God's redemptive activity, and yet who turned away or simply did not respond in faith, that theirs was a precarious place. And so throughout this letter, we have numerous warnings to those who were in that category. But as we look at our text this morning, we have a text that is aimed at believers. It is aimed at those who had expressed true faith in Jesus Christ and yet were facing obstacles and were challenged in the living out of their faith. And so as we study this text this morning, it serves for us as a very appropriate reminder at this time in our lives, at the end of one year, at the start of another, of the need for endurance, the need for a right perspective for living the Christian life. And in these verses, we find a very helpful set of instructions which are very helpful in terms of self-evaluation as well as planning for the year ahead. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 read as follows. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. This particular exhortation follows upon an exhortation that was given right before chapter 11. We know chapter 11 to be that great hall of faith. Heroes from the Old Testament who demonstrated lives of faith. But immediately before chapter 11 begins with this chronicle of Old Testament faithful living, we have this exhortation given at the end of chapter 10 in verse 39, where the writer writes these words as he emphasizes in this particular section the need for endurance. He writes this in chapter 10, verse 39. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. That emphasis on endurance then is followed up in chapter 11 by this hall of faith, the great list of Old Testament saints. And then that concept or theme of endurance is raised once again in this exhortation of verses 1 and 2 of chapter 12. And in these verses of Hebrews 12, the writer exhorts us to exercise endurance in the Christian life. It is a very important, a very essential reminder to us as we think of the year ahead. And the writer emphasizes this endurance by likening the Christian life to a race, and then by giving us instructions about how to live this life, how to run this race victoriously. I want to unpack these instructions for you this morning, and I'll do so by drawing your attention to five observations or five ingredients of this instruction that we find in these verses. And these are the five ingredients, and we'll go through them one by one. First of all, there is a foundational command. Secondly, an inspiring motivation. Third, a particular preparation. Fourth, the essential means. And then fifth, the ultimate example. Let's look at the first of these ingredients, the heart of this section, the emphasis of these two verses. It's the fundamental command, and it's found in the middle of these two verses, really at the end of verse 1, and it reads as follows: let us run with endurance the race set before us. That's the foundational or fundamental command, a very straightforward, very vivid, picturesque commandment. This is the central exhortation that the writer of Hebrews wants his readers, he wants us to draw from all of his instructions, all of his teaching in this letter. Let us run with endurance the race set before us. In fact, we could add to that foundational or fundamental command the very first word here in verse 1, therefore. Therefore, let us run with endurance. Now, that word therefore is a very strong word. In fact, it's not the typical word for therefore that we find in the original. It's a very unusual, rare term that really emphasizes a logical inference, and it draws our attention to the immediately preceding words at the end of chapter 11. Notice what the writer writes there as he wraps up that section on the heroes of the faith. He says this in verse 39 of chapter 11, and all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised because God had provided something better for us so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. What the writer is emphasizing at the end of chapter 11 is that this great hall of faith, this list of heroes of the Old Testament, lived the lives that they did in an inferior environment. They didn't have what we as church age saints enjoy. They had less. They lived prior to the first advent of Christ. They lived without the whole counsel of God. They had the promises. They clung to those promises, but those promises would be realized after their time, and they would be realized in our time. We would be the ones who would have something better. In fact, that's where the transition occurs. The writer contrasts those, verse 39, and then in verse 1 of chapter 12, he refers to us, to we. And we could even see this contrast even further or earlier in chapter 11 when we read, for example, verse 13 of chapter 11. Notice there again, the writer emphasizes that those who are described in chapter 11, those who are heroes, were able to live a life of enduring faith with far less than what we enjoy today. Notice verse 13 of chapter 11. All these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. And then chapter 12 comes. And the writer says, therefore, in light of this, let's draw out a conclusion here. Therefore, let us run with endurance. Let us, in contrast to those, let us, those who have received the promises, those who didn't just see them from afar, but those in whose context these promises of a better priesthood given to Christ, of a better kingship, of one who is the inaugurator of a better covenant and a better rest, as those who have been recipients, who see them up close, let us run with endurance. In fact, this command as a pronoun that doesn't easily translate into our English language, but you could translate it this way, therefore, let us ourselves run with endurance the race set before us. The writer draws from the world of sport, of athletics, and certainly our culture is not the only one in history that is centered on sports. So much of even what we talk about, so many of the analogies we even use in our everyday language, so many of those are drawn from athletics, and we're not the first ones to do that. In fact, this all goes back to the Greco-Roman culture, which was saturated with pictures of sports. And the writer draws from that, and even the Jewish audience to which he writes was very familiar with these sport metaphors. The writer likens the Christian life to a race. And the word for race there is the word from which we get the word agony. And the idea of agony was used to describe athletic competitions because it was assumed, it was well known that to compete in athletic competitions, you needed exertion. You needed discipline. You must exhibit careful concentration and maximum effort. And the writer draws from that world, draws from that imagery to describe the Christian life, and he calls it running a race. He calls upon us to run this race, and he uses that language to indicate that this is not just an occasional effort. This is not just a limited sprint. This is a race, a lifelong race, a life that requires exertion, a life that cannot be lived passively. It's a life that requires discipline and careful concentration and maximum effort. The writer describes this race as a race set before us. As part of this fundamental command, he says, run the race set before us. That language indicates that the racetrack that is before us is not something we determine. It's not something we have the right to choose. It has been prepared for us by the master of the games. The master is the one who determines the duration, the distance. The master is the one who determines the rules of engagement. The master is the one who determines the rewards. And we as runners must recognize that we don't choose this path, but it has been carefully determined for us. And of course, we ask the question, who specifically is the one who puts the path before us? If we think of the year ahead of us, 2026, who is it that has determined the path that we will encounter in the next calendar year? And although the writer doesn't mention his name here, he certainly assumes that this is God himself. It is God who has determined the path ahead of us. It is God who has determined the duration, the length, the kind of obstacles that we will encounter along the way. It is God who has determined the way, the rules in which this course will be run. This is not an accident. It is not a coincidence. It's not merely the random the collision of atoms in the universe. It's not blind fate. No, we know, especially going into a new year, that the path has been established. That is God's doing. But the responsibility of endurance, of running, is what God has put in our hands and has called upon us to run this race set before us. This is the Christian life, and this is the life that has been assigned to us. Run the race that God has set before you. That's the fundamental command. Now, in light of that, we have an inspiring motivation. Not only do we have the fundamental command, but an inspiring motivation. If you're a runner, a big aspect of running is the motivation that keeps you going. And the writer provides us with such motivation. Notice the beginning of verse 1. He says, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us. Since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us. Now let's pull that apart and understand the emphases that the writer is making here in this motivational statement. He says, since we have. He's not referring to something that was possessed in the past. He's referring to something we possess now. We have it now. And what do we have? He calls it a great cloud of witnesses. In fact, the language is so great a cloud of witnesses. That language, so great, emphasizes large quantity, a massive amount. So great. And then he says, a cloud of witnesses. And again, that word, that imagery of cloud emphasizes both vastness and unity. It's one, it's a cloud. Clouds are always large. And he says, this is so great a cloud of witnesses. Notice that word there, of witnesses. Now, of course, in light of the context, we immediately connect that term witnesses back to chapter 11. They are the great cloud of witnesses, men and women like Abel and Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Rahab, Gideon, Samson, David, Samuel, the prophets, innumerable, really, Old Testament saints who ran the race, who've already testified to the nature of this course. And what they serve as witnesses to is not our running. That's often assumed. The idea is that, among some, is that they're the ones who are witnessing our running. But that's not the idea of the text. The text here does not describe or is not intending to describe those Old Testament saints as witnesses to our running, as observers of us. Instead, the idea of witnessing is an active idea, and it means to give testimony to something. And what they are giving testimony to as a cloud of witnesses is they are giving testimony to the nature of true faith. This cloud of witnesses that surround us is not occupied with how we're running. Instead, what they are occupied with is speaking to us through their examples, speaking to us about how to run the race. That's what they're engaged in through their examples. Notice, for example, how this is carried through in verse 4 of chapter 11. In verse 4 of chapter 11, we have the first great hero of the faith, Abel. And the writer says this of Abel: by faith, here we have true faith, by faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts. And through faith, now notice this, the end of verse 4, through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. That's the testimony that is involved from this cloud of witnesses. And this cloud of witnesses, as they all in unison testify to us about the nature of a life of faith, they're described as surrounding us. Again, it picks up the idea of a racetrack, of a hippodrome in the ancient Greco-Roman world. And you have the people all around, and that's the idea here. But again, they're not observing us, they're speaking to us, but they're doing so surrounding us, indicating that they do so from every side. And this indicates to us, as part of this motivational inspiration, that there are many who have already run this race. It can be done. And in fact, we see the nature of the logic of the writer's argument. He's saying, look at this hall of faith. Look at how they have run, and they did so with far less than you. And those who have far less than you have done it, and they are speaking to you through the scriptures, through their examples. They are speaking to you about the nature of this course, and they are doing so from every side. Abel and Enoch and Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Rahab, Gideon, Samson, David, Samuel, the prophets. They're speaking to you from every side. It's not as if we lack the inspiration. It's there, the writer says. From that, he then moves on to the decisive requirement. Not only is there the fundamental command to run the race, the inspiring motivation, the surrounding cloud of witnesses, there is also the decisive requirement. That's the third ingredient here. Notice also the middle of verse 1. Here's the requirement. Let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles. Now, it's stated in our translation as another exhortation, but there is really only one command in this sentence of verses 1 and 2. It's the command to run the race. In fact, you could translate this better as follows: having laid aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles, let us run the race. The language here assumes this decisive requirement. It's something that has to be done in order to run the race well, to run the race successfully. And again, the writer is drawing from this analogy of Greco-Roman athletics. Because as the runners would show up for the contest, no one would just move to the racetrack and run wearing his street clothes. No, it was known in those days that all that was superfluous, all the articles of clothing that were superfluous needed to be discarded before the runner took his place at the starting line. And that is what the writer is calling upon us to do as well in the Christian life. And it's important for us, especially to consider this as we start a new year, as we come to, you could say, another starting line, the starting line of January 1st, 2026. So what does the writer call upon us to discard? He calls upon us to discard two things. He uses the language of taking off articles of clothing. And the first thing that he calls upon us to discard is every encumbrance. Notice that in verse 1. Let us lay aside every encumbrance. Now again, the runner would lay aside all that was unnecessary, go to great lengths even to lose any little bit of weight that was not necessary for the running of the race. And that is what the writer calls upon us to do in terms of the Christian life. Every encumbrance. Now, the encumbrance for the original readers of this letter, Jewish as they were, would have been things like the Old Testament customs and traditions, the things that had accumulated in the Jewish lifestyle, things both drawn directly from the Mosaic Law as well as things added to it over time. Now, those things in and of themselves, especially when lived out in the appropriate time, were not inherently evil. They were even good. But now a new time had come. Christ had come. He had brought a climax and conclusion to all the things to which the Old Testament law pointed. And so now those things could be encumbrances that needed to be cast aside. But the writer here isn't wanting us to limit this requirement just to that particular historical situation. He uses the language of every encumbrance. The idea here is not to limit, but to cast it broadly. Anything which is distracting, anything which might be innocent in itself, even good, but that which distracts or hinders the living out of the Christian life in a way that pleases the Lord, that those things need to be cast aside. Even innocent things in our lives can inhibit. Even innocent things, things that are good in themselves, can be distorted and become obstacles for us, to cause us to run slowly or even stumble. And the writer says, cast them aside. The second thing that he calls upon us to cast aside is the sin which so easily entangles us. Now he deals with that which is explicitly unlawful, that which is explicitly contrary to the character of God and his will for us. Now, the first category dealt with that which is not necessarily wrong or sinful in itself, but this one deals with that which is sinful. And he likens sin to that which entangles the runner. And to put it into perhaps a more modern day analogy here would be to have barbed wire on the racetrack, and to run into that barbed wire, there's no way you're getting out. In fact, the more you struggle and the more you try, the more tangled up you get. And that is the nature of sin. You cannot run the race entangled in sin of any kind. Once the barb gets stuck, And you don't stop and remove it. You just keep running. It digs in further and further, and you become slower and slower until finally you stumble and fall right into that barbed wire. And the writer says, cast it off. Cast it off. Make that decisive action and cast off that sin. And this is always an ever-present instruction for us, no matter where we're at in the calendar year, to examine our lives and to think of that sin which perhaps is entangling us and to cast it off immediately. We dare not toy with it. The longer we find ourselves in its barbs, the more those barbs sink, and so we must take decisive action. But perhaps as we get ready to change calendars, this is a good time to examine ourselves and say, okay, where are those sins? Perhaps they're smaller, more insidious, more nuanced. Now is the time, as we prepare for the race set before us of 2026, to deal decisively with those sins. Now, there's a fourth ingredient in this set of instructions, and it too is found at the end of verse 1, and it's the essential means. The essential means, and it's a very small phrase, but don't lose sight of it. It's the phrase, with endurance. With endurance, let us run the race that is set before us with endurance. To endure means to maintain a belief or a course of action in the face of opposition. And by adding this little phrase, with endurance, the writer is telling us that the race of the Christian life is not easy. We must expect opposition. We must expect that there will be obstacles on the course. And so endurance, the ability to maintain belief and course of action in the face of opposition, this endurance is essential. And it shows us that what is most important as we think of the Christian life, and even as we think of the year ahead, what is most important is not sprinting. What is most important is stamina, of maintaining belief and that course of action. It's integral to living well. And we don't have time this morning, but as I said, in this section from chapter 10, verse 19, all the way through the end of chapter 12, endurance, or synonyms for that term, are used over and over again to emphasize what is essential for living well, the cultivation of endurance. And this endurance is no mere passive patience. It's an active effort. One writer, Horatius Bonar, as he summarized this necessity, he described the need for endurance in these words. He said this, quote, "The road to the kingdom is not so pleasant and comfortable and easy and flowery as many dream. It is not a bright, sunny avenue of palms. It is not paved with triumph, though it is to end in victory. The termination is glory, honor, and immortality, but on the way there is the thorn in the flesh, the sackcloth, and the cross. Recompense later, but labor here. Rest later, but weariness here. Joy and security later, but here endurance and watchfulness. The race, the battle, the burden, the stumbling block, and oftentimes the heavy heart." And so the writer here exhorts us to cultivate endurance. Now that's a lofty call. In fact, in many ways you could say it's impossible. On our own strength, by our own effort to cultivate endurance so that we could run with endurance, it is beyond our ability. But that's what leads us then to the final ingredient in these instructions, and it's found in verse 2. The ultimate example. The fifth component here is the ultimate example that the writer gives us. Notice verse 2. It's all of verse 2, and this is how the writer expresses it. He says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of the faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, there's a lot to draw from this, but let's make a few observations about this ultimate example. Back in verse 1, we saw the inspiring motivation was the cloud of witnesses that surround us. But the writer's very clear here that our eyesight is not to be fixed on that cloud of witnesses. They speak to us, they speak into our ears, but our eyes, notice the beginning of this verse, our eyes are fixed on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith. And that idea of fixing our eyes includes within its definition the necessity of turning eyesight away from other objects and looking on to a specific one. And that specific object is Jesus. And he's described here as the author and perfecter of our faith. Now, what's important here is to note that there's different ways to understand these titles, but the best way to understand these titles are in terms of Jesus as the example and Jesus as the perfecter, the one who brings us through to the end. Let's look at both of these very quickly. First of all, Jesus is the author. You could translate it as Jesus is the pioneer. Now, throughout most of Hebrews, the focus is on how Jesus is so unique. Jesus is incomparable. He is superior. He is ultimate in every way and in comparison to everything. And yet, at certain times in this letter, the writer does point to Jesus as the one who is our example to follow. And that's the idea here in this first title. He is the pioneer. He is the forerunner of the faith. He is the first in a series. He is the archetype. He is the ultimate runner of the race, the ultimate example for us to follow. And so our eyes must be fixed on him because he is at the finish line. He has already finished the course. Fix your eyes on him. But there's a second idea here. He is called the perfecter of our faith. The idea here is one who brings something to a successful conclusion. He is not only the one who has run the race before us, but he's also the one who brings us to the same conclusion where he is at. As one writer said, he strode ahead of all believers in faith and led faith to its definitive end. This is Jesus, and this is important. And as we're going to see in the remaining words, this is important because it's not we who are the perfecter of our faith. It's Jesus. He is the one who gets us to the finish line, and therefore the one on whom we must set our eyes. And notice how this is described at the end of verse 2. Notice how he is described. Who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, what is amazing to note here is that a lot of that language that comes at in the second half of verse 2 is language that has been drawn from verse 1. Notice how Jesus ran. He endured the cross. There's the same concept of endurance. In fact, he too had something set before him. He, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross. That was his course. He also divested himself of that which encumbered. Notice how he despised the shame of that disgraceful cross. He did not allow it to deter him from his goal. And notice how he finished. He sat down at the right hand of God. That's the place of the victor. To sit down. He ran the course and he sat down victorious. But don't miss the concept here of sitting down as it relates to the ministry of Jesus even today in perfecting our faith. There is an important reason why Jesus is at the right hand of the Father. This was alluded to previously in Hebrews 7, verse 25, where the writer there said, "He is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them." Chapter 8, verse 1 says, "Now the main point in what has been said is this: we have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens." The emphasis here in this language is that Jesus is there to provide everything that we need in the time of need, everything that we cannot manufacture ourselves. And we are to fix our eyes on him at the beginning of this new year, because he is the one who intercedes, and he is the only one who is able to save to the uttermost. And by fixing our eyes on him, by placing full dependence upon him, of recognizing him as the one who has run before us, who has set the example, and as the one who will get us through to the end, we will be able to run this race with endurance. As we close, let me give you five questions that follow these five ingredients. Number one, are you exhorting effort in the Christian life? That's the command, to run the race set before you. Number two, are you accepting the testimony of those who have gone before you? The scriptures, these lives of the saints, speak into our lives to show us this can be done. Are you accepting that testimony? Number three, the requirement, are you shedding the things which impede your progress? Are you ready to take decisive action, not just on January 1st, but in every day of your life? Number four, the means. Are you cultivating the virtue of perseverance? Do you recognize that this takes active endurance, not a passivity, but an active endurance? And then number five, the example. Are you steadfast in your focus on Jesus Christ for both his example that he has set as well as his power to save you, to bring you to the finish line? That is where your focus is to be as we begin a new year. Let's pray. Father, we are grateful for Jesus Christ. We are thankful that not only does he provide for us the superior sacrifice, not only does he provide for us the superior priesthood, not only does his blood secure the superior covenant, but he is also the superior intercessor who is able to save us to the uttermost. And as we run the race of this next year, give us the strength we need to run with endurance and constantly draw our focus always back to your Son, who provides us not only with the example, but also with the security. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen.